Hi guys, welcome back to the Revive Stronger podcast. This is part two with Ben Escrow. And if you're coming back for part two, that means you enjoyed part one. And this one is super duper interesting as well. We talk about some supplements that Ben is currently interested in and he's got his eye on. He is always on the cutting edge of the new and best thing that's actually evidence-based in terms of supplementation. So it's very interesting hearing about that. Maybe some issues with taking some supplements alongside drugs or medication and some things for you to really be aware of. And I think this was really valuable as anyone who is kind of taking supplements and cares about their health and wants to get the best from things. I definitely recommend listening to it all. And if you didn't hear me last time, this is maybe going to be one of the final reminders that the Improvement Season podcast that was on this podcast provider is now its separate thing. If you're on YouTube, you're hearing both and you're seeing both anyway. But if you're on a podcast provider, you'll know these are now separate, or now you know. And if you want to join us for the Improvement Season with myself and Pascal, just basically going back and forth and having a fun time and many things related to fitness, of course, and our journeys, then definitely search for it and you'll be able to find us. And we'll gladly have your ears. But without further ado, let's get into the show with Ben.
See the response you get. And I think a lot of people would be shocked.
It's funny. It's something I hadn't really thought about much until last year. Oh no, the year before last now. Damn, time flies. And I was competing and like on show day, I'd been having this pre-workout and like it didn't have these like various tests for it. And I was just like, it's just not worth me taking this anymore. Like if they take me for a piss test and it comes up and I'm, banned now for 10 years or whatever it is, like it's just not worth it. So I think like there's a number of like natural competitors who are listening, and I'm probably 9 times out of 10 people will be fine about it. I guess like you're just fortunate, but it could be that one time you get caught out on it.
Well, and I think especially for a drug tested competitor, you do want to see one of those independent third party tests that just validates that there's no banned substances in it, because that of really all the testing that you can do as a company, that's probably the most affordable. When you do, like, for example, we typically in runs will do a validation just to make sure our manufacturer isn't fluffing us on you know what they say they put in the amounts, because think about that, you know, it's very expensive to run supplements. A manufacturer who just wants the max profit margins, it sounds like we're talking about, you know, black market, you know, drugs where they put brick dust in cocaine or something. But you still want to know. I certainly want to know as a supplement seller and formulator that everything that I intended to be in there at those amounts is in there. So it requires a little more complex analysis to do, because you have to go ingredient by ingredient and you're paying per ingredient you're doing on that assay. So that adds up quite a bit, especially if you're doing it for every batch, for every flavor, for all of those things. So I think, especially, so those are kind of our three categories we define. If price isn't a factor for you and you just want the highest quality, look for licensed as many of the ingredients on the panel as possible. I think all three categories I'm going to say should avoid proprietary blends, because that's just a way to hide things in there. I think the second category is if you are price shopping, which is probably most people, find some additional layer that what's in there, what they're saying is in there, is in there. If you can't find it, ask the company. And then for the people who are specifically looking for something that's definitely drug-free, you definitely want to have a seal of third-party approval. Like some of those I mentioned before, NSF Safe for Sport, the green check mark, BSCG, LCG or LSG is another one. There's quite a few out there, but you just want to see that seal.
It's really tough, because the more we've spoken through it, if the supplement company or the people running it, if their heart isn't in the right place, you've almost got every incentive to like make things as cheap as possible and take as many of those risks that things aren't what they are. And then let's be honest, a lot of supplements, the marketing and the placebo effect is huge for them. So if you're probably as a business person, more incentivized to put all your money towards marketing, put it less towards actually the product itself, and go down that route. And obviously you'd hope that doesn't breed longevity and But I imagine like you've seen a lot of companies go through that. Like you think at least you can see they've made that decision.
The reality is, I'm not going to name brand names, but the reality is it's a marketing machine. And I think to get to the highest level, you have to, as you said, probably be at least balanced 50-50 marketing and then product development. But I think some ways are less harmful than others. Like there's certain brands who are trying to blend sort of streetwear culture with supplements and make it sort of sexier to buy supplements and merch, where they blend a merch company with a supplement company. And I think that's less harmful. It just hypes up, you know, like the packaging looks cool. And even a lot of them now, I've seen that their formulas are decent. Like they're not bad. So I think that marketing approach is not as dangerous as some of the others who I'd say appeal to the more desperate consumer, where they really want gains at any cost. So, you know, they'll say this will be the strongest stim and it's got everything in there that's banned and has been banned for the past 5 years. But of course, you know, they'll sell it as a research chemical rather than a supplement or something like that. But yeah, I mean, you put it well. And I think just to use another explanation for it, it still does operate a lot like the Wild West. And I think what I saw when I was first getting in was it was a lot more open before more regulation from the FDA came in, especially about with the exotic stimulants and pro hormones and stuff. It operated a lot more like the Wild West. And especially like, I'm going to be careful how I describe this, because this person was an inspiration for me. And I actually think he was very brilliant, but he definitely did things that walked the line, I considered, and that was Patrick Arnold, with a company called ErgoPharm originally. And, you know, he introduced DMAA to the market, which a lot of people don't know. So before it really blew up, he had a product that first brought it to the market. And he also, before DMAA, he brought a lot of the designer sort of anabolics to the market, like 1AD, which was 1-testosterone, was his creation. And he was a chemist, so he was able to synthesize these things in a lab, and by the legal loophole, because they were derivatives of DHEA, they weren't actually classified as anabolic steroids, and they were orally active. So I think he was brilliant, but I'd say willing to probably do some things that maybe I wouldn't be. But that's definitely harder to do, because now I think, you know, the FDA after that period of time smartened up and just made these blanket clauses about certain ingredients to limit that. But yeah, it's tough. It's tough. Every time I try to go down a practical route, I get lost in these technical details of like, oh man, it's not so simple. And it's like these realizations I have of like, okay, I'm trying to make it simple, but oh shit, it's not as simple as I'd like it to be.
I think you gave some really good practical tips for the consumer, though, especially things like they all know it with when you're trying to buy like some nutritionally based, if you're trying to hit certain goals, you don't just look at, oh, which one looks the tastiest. You look at the ingredients or the macros on the back, and that gives you more of information of, is it goal driven? Same with like, again, like we've said, the supplement industry is so marketing heavy. Try and look past that and look at actually, what am I getting from this product?
Yeah.
Versus just like the hype behind it or the influencer who's hyping it up. Like, look at actually, is it better than this other one? Do a little bit of digging that way. I'm interested, Ben, is there anything you're currently working on? Is there any formulations you're looking at? Any supplements you've currently kind of seen that seem to be like you're interested in?
I'd say I'm always fascinated by what I would consider the most influenceable factor that you have as a formulator in the space for drug tested athletes, which is kind of energy products and things that influence just feels. I think you could build the strongest argument that's the last frontier that's left, where you can still really make a difference in a way someone feels it. So I always keep my eye open. I think it gets harder and harder. Like I talked the last episode I did on Honor Culture, I talked about paraxanthine. I think that was fascinating. Paraxanthine is a metabolite of caffeine that does feel a little bit differently. If you give it, like if you've ever used caffeine, you felt the effects of paraxanthine, but when you give it in pure form, you just get that purified experience of stimulation that normally you'd only get sort of halfway through caffeine metabolism. And that was fascinating. There was a lot of interesting, I think, just technical journeys they had to go through to launch that. And there was innovation involved in that. So that was cool. That was something that I would have liked to have been able to launch, just didn't have the resource. I think there's other potentially supplements like stimulant support ingredients that fascinate me. Like one of them is just derivatives of tyrosine, because, you know, when you mix tyrosine in, tyrosine is a good stimulant support ingredient. You know, it's a precursor to all of the classical neurotransmitters that are really feel good chemicals. And you can have an influence on both stimulation and sort of the come down effects of stimulation with a lot of those precursors. I don't have the best technical or physiological reason why, but just anecdotally, whenever I've small batch formulas, I've always found that when you include some of those precursors in, it seems to not be as harsh of a come down versus something that's just kind of straight caffeine. The limitations and difficulties with tyrosine is when you give it in pure form, it is bioavailable, but it's very poorly water soluble. So it's not the best experience, and it's very difficult to dose it as high as you need to. Like pure tyrosine, if you want to really get the best effects, you need it like 5 grams plus. That's hard to do because it mixes like milk when you mix it in water. I mean, you really can't solubilize more than 500 milligrams in like 300 to 500 milliliters of water. That's very, very low solubility for a classical supplement ingredient. There are alternatives you can use, but at least the data we have now shows that they don't really make it well in systemic circulation, or they don't make it into the central nervous system, which is what you need to influence energy and stimulation. So one of those is N-acetyltyrosine, which is what we use just because it's soluble and it doesn't impact as poorly the user experience, but you can get some in. It's just not as potent as normal tyrosine. So it's kind of like you're picking your weakness that you want to utilize that you want to take as a formulator. Since it's not as strong as caffeine, I think I just accept, okay, you know, we'll put a high dose of N-acetyl in there. And even if 20% gets it into the blood, we'll accept that since it's not the primary ingredient in the formulation. There are potential ways to navigate around that. There are alternatives of tyrosine that have been fascinating to me. I haven't seen used yet. I'm going to be fairly tight-lipped about it. I mean, anybody who listens, who is formulation savvy, probably can find what those are. But I think that's an interesting avenue. I don't think you're going to be able to make this billion-dollar product on tyrosine analogs, because they're just not as potent as like a classical stimulant, like a yohimbine or caffeine or anything like that. So yeah, I think some of those more nuanced things are fascinating for me. I'm always interested in stuff in the muscle building category. Like terkesterone fascinated me, but I think just the deeper I dove in, the more it was just disappointing, because I wanted to believe just like everybody else did, every consumer wanted to believe. And I mean, what's crazy is like, terkesterone is an ecdysteroid. Ecdysteroids have been around since like the 60s, and they were popular in the 90s as well. But it was sold as ecdysterone, which you could source and you can get a relatively high potency powder of ecdysteroids. So they used to sell like, it was 20 beta ecdysteroid or ecdysterone, and you can get like a 90% or so powder. And that never really led to much, but there was still this data back then that suggested terkesterone is the most potent of the ecdysteroids. And it just kind of blew my mind that it just completely disappeared in the 90s. And then magically it just gets revitalized. I don't know what necessarily caused that, because certainly the research didn't support that. Oh my God, terkesterone is something every supplement company needs to sell. But somebody, I think, just found that they could capitalize on that maybe plausible possibility at that point in time that terkesterone might be this magic thing, or there's just not enough to disprove it. So we can just push hard for a little period of time until enough comes to push back on it. But I really think now, sort of in hindsight, and I did mention this on the Iron Culture podcast as well, when we talked about terkesterone, I think a lot of companies were probably just selling probably ectosterone. That was probably very low yield terkesterone in that blend, and they just didn't care, because the one thing is, you know, when you have a pure compound, like when you're talking about things that aren't nutrients, you could build a case that this might not be true. But for the most part, a pure compound that's a supplement ingredient is almost always going to be white. So if it's above 95% purity, it's usually not going to be colored. And a lot of those things that were sold as terkesterone and ectosterone were not white. They weren't white powders. And you can look at, you know, a lot of these companies that sell research chemicals. If you're really, again, if you want to be really nerdy about it, you can go on to a company like Sigma Aldrich, or just Google like that raw ingredients chemical name. So you could Google terkesterone and you could find on the Sigma website that they sell pure terkesterone for a research chemical for an academic institution who wants to study it. And it will be validated that it's pure by their high level, high specificity analytical instruments. And it says right on the assay that it's white. It'll say white or off white. So you know, like, it's not just Ben making it up, like this general statement of like, oh, it's got to be a white powder. Like, we actually have the tests that say a pure version of terkesterone is white. So if you were getting something that wasn't, you definitely weren't getting what you were being told you were. But how many people, especially consumers, unless you're fanatical about it like me, are going to buy that product and then send it out for a third-party test and see if it actually contains that? You're asking people to invest 10x on what they did on just buying the bottle, you know?
No, absolutely. Yeah, I know from Utopia, which I don't know if that's like one of your favorite products you've made, but it's certainly one I really enjoyed because I felt the difference between having that and like a coffee or a Monster or whatever it is. Like, I feel that. And yeah, it's nice when you can feel it as a consumer as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. You know, again, to touch on something I mentioned before, is I really consider myself split down the middle, as on one side formulator, on the other side still consumer. So I really want a product that I always wanted, or that I see as a void in the current market. Now, I will be the first to admit that window closes every year as things get more competitive and bigger brands, more well-funded, or just more, maybe there's more incentivization for formulators in an expanding industry where I think better formulators have come in, more knowledgeable. And I think what I really am most proud of about a product like Utopia is I was able to sort of satisfy a lot of the things that DMAA did without using DMAA, just by touching on some of the mechanisms that DMAA, like the pathways that it kind of activated. For example, a lot of stimulants are dopaminergic. And dopamine, like caffeine is very dopaminergic. That's why it's very hard to kick the caffeine habit. But if you use things that are more specifically work on dopamine, for example, like L-DOPA, which is a direct precursor to dopamine synthesis, you will get a more pronounced dopamine response if you combine it with caffeine. Now, these are things that I think you have to be, I would say, careful with, because you don't want to go super high with direct precursors like that. Like, for example, like a direct precursor of serotonin is 5-HTP. If you go too high on that, it's going to make you sick. Like, you'll get nauseous, you might puke. So dose is everything. And I think this is a universal concept in every field I've ever been involved in. Like nutrition, we know dose is everything. Like, a certain amount of macros will make you unhealthy, a certain amount will make you healthier, and a certain amount will maintain you. We know this with hydration, we know this with loading and programming. So it's supplements exist that rule still applies in supplements, is dose is essential. It matters. And, you know, things like L-DOPA are given at like very far high ranges for clinical situations, like people with Parkinson's. And at those dosage, like 8 grams a day, it can be a problem. And I mean, I've seen companies dose it at levels where I'm like, man, that's concerning. Because for me, when you get really around a gram, that's a lot. That's a lot of a direct precursor to dopamine. You might be messing with things you don't want to mess with. So I think the not just the original formulation of Utopia, but the evolution of it as well, as I kind of learn more about building in protective things for, we never dosed it higher. Like at most we kept it at 150. But as I learn more about, okay, like what if somebody's going to triple dose this in a day? How can I try to build in some protective thing, which is balancing the serotonergic with the dopaminergic? So we put in a small amount of 5-HTP in there. And I think these little nuances are probably not recognizable. I don't think you really feel the 5-HTP, but it's something that at least gives me peace of mind, where we're not just loading someone up and be like, oh my God, I know they're going to feel the dopamine here. Let's give them 5 grams. But it does actually lead me to another point of interest, I think, in the conversation, which this one is a little more technical, but it's just something I think for just general consumers to be aware of, which is interactions, which is drug supplement interactions or supplement supplement interactions. And they're very real. Like that will exist with, for example, let's say someone's on an antidepressant. You do need to be careful of taking products that directly influence neurotransmitters. Maybe not so much caffeine, but definitely like if you're on a classical antidepressant, which is a serotonin based one. I'm trying to think of the names. Let's say Wellbutrin or something. You do need to be aware that, especially if they're making serotonin float longer in the synaptic cleft. So I forget what they're called, serotonin like reuptake inhibitors. If you add more serotonin by using a product that has a serotonin precursor, that could be potentially a problem and a concern. So I think especially if you're on current medications, you either need to ask a medical professional or do some extra layer of work to make sure that that's not a dangerous thing for you to be taking. Because I do see that a lot of people will be on a medication and think, oh, it's a supplement, like it's fine, it's not a drug, when in reality supplements can have drug-like effects. Like caffeine is a drug, it can be sold as a supplement. Even people like females who are on birth control will impact your ability to metabolize caffeine. So it will to some degree inhibit CYP1A2, which is the main pathway that metabolizes caffeine. So you will be more sensitive to caffeine if you're on birth control. So these are things to, I think, that are good to be aware of, or just aware that you should be aware that they can have some type of interaction. Even things like people I think believe are sort of harmless, like, oh, let's rewind back a little bit to talk about immunity formulations. Things like single ingredient micronutrients like zinc. You see a lot, you know, zinc, for good reason, is a main component in an immune support product, but there is an upper limit threshold for zinc in a day, which is 50 milligrams. And a lot of times, like an acute a product that's meant to be used acutely, like let's say an emergency or an airborne or something, it might have pretty close to that upper limit. So acutely, you can get away with it. But if you're taking 50 milligrams of zinc for a long time, that could be a problem. And one of the main drawbacks is copper deficiency. So the reason this is especially relevant is I just had a nutrition client startup who's taking 50 milligrams long term. And I said, you know, I think we should check your serum copper if you want to stay on that supplement long term. We need to check your copper, because that could lead to a long term problem. So I think just an awareness that not everything, just because it's sold as a supplement, is inherently safe. And then a layer on top of it is if you're taking any traditional prescription medications, you do need to be a little more careful than the person who's not.
Do you not see the progress you would like? Are you sick of writing your own programs? Or perhaps you need some accountability in order to stick with the plan? Then it's time to start working with us. We at Revive Stronger offer a truly personalized coaching service. You'll get more than just an email with some macros or random cookie cutter program. With Revive Stronger, you will be the center of our attention. You will receive your own fully individualized training protocol alongside a customized nutritional strategy. We create the coaching around your needs, wants, personal preferences, and your own unique lifestyle. Every single week, we delve into your program in order to make appropriate adjustments so that we get the most out of your time and the best possible outcome. We help both female and male athletes to seriously change their body composition by adding more muscle mass and decreasing fat tissue. No matter if you're a competitive bodybuilder or just want to look better, if you need help with your progress and taking your physique to the next level, our coaching is for you. It's time to make a change. Sign up today and let's revive stronger.
I think that's really well said, because I think people do completely take it for granted. Even myself, like, people just, you know, they chuck in a multivitamin and they're just like, yeah, it's fine. And like, they do all these various things. I know for a time I was taking a high dose of vitamin D, vitamin D basically, which obviously yeah. accumulates. And it's quite hard to go above like your upper limit. But I did when I got like a blood test done, because I wasn't feeling too good. And I don't know if it was the vitamin D, but like, there's just things like that where I was like, oh yeah, high vitamin D, that's good for immunity and whatever, there could be benefits. But it's like, like, you don't know what's going under the hood sometimes with these things. So it's really good to have that knowledge.
Eric has said the same thing. Helms, he said he had hypercalcemia from a fairly moderate dose of vitamin D. So yeah, again, great point for us to kind of elaborate on a little more there is when you're talking nutrients, like, let's get away from stimulants and botanicals, just individual nutrients. I think the things that you need to be most cautious of are especially fat-soluble vitamins. So that's A, D, E, K. D, especially, because you can get these high-potency forms that are made to be used for someone like a once-a-month dosage, like a 10,000 IU or a 20,000 IU. There could be a very real issue with taking that much, especially if you're taking it daily. So, well, again, let me try to take a step back and say, what's the practical way of addressing that? And this is what I recommend to anybody that directly ask me questions about taking supplements or if they should take a supplement. I always say, get a lab test first. You can get a vitamin D lab test. Some of them are harder because they're not as easy to catch vitamin status, especially for the water-soluble vitamins. They're just harder to test. But for minerals and for fat-soluble vitamins, I think before you start those, you should probably get a pretest, because a medical professional or the current medical opinion says everybody is at risk of vitamin D deficiency doesn't mean you're vitamin D deficient. You don't even know your baseline yet. So what if you're fine and you're taking a supplement makes you go too high? Like I'll give you, you know, my own personal medical information is I actually don't take a vitamin D supplement even in the winter, because my serum vitamin D is normal. I'm within normal range. So I have no real reason to do it. And it's not like I'm borderline normal. Like, I'm smack right within the normal range. So there's no real use for it. And I've done the same thing. Like, I do practice what I preach is, I do take zinc. I take about a 20 milligram dose of zinc, and I've tested my copper, and I continue to do follow-up testing on my copper just to make sure, because I'm aware that that's an issue. I think those are things, that's something that anybody could do. Like, either you can go and ask your GP, you know, I'm taking the supplement, I'd like to have my levels tested, or I'm considering the supplement, I'd like to have my levels tested. And if you don't want to go through a doctor, now there's this like explosion of private lab clinics where you can go online and just buy a lab test, and you're going to pay a little more. But the way I look at it is, okay, if you're going to, you could potentially spend $100 to $150 to know your status versus spend a lot more long term if you end up having a problem from chronic use of a supplement. And last point to touch on botanicals and toxicity as well. is you do need to have considerations of really high dose botanicals, because there are case studies of people that have used things like one of them is an anti-anxiety called Kava Kava. People have actually been hospitalized for liver failure, acute liver failure, on using wow. that. A lot of times you'll see people who really load up on botanicals will have elevated liver enzymes, because a lot of times those can be hepatotoxic, because your liver is basically processing or cleansing these things. So at high dose, again, to go back to something I said before, you know, dose is everything. And just because it's a botanical and it's a plant, it doesn't mean it's inherently safe. And a lot of times, even, again, sorry, I'm soapboxing a little bit, but even things like vegan products, like vegan proteins, or high cacao dark chocolates, because they're soil derived, you are going to get heavy metals and other things in there that could potentially be dangerous. And again, that's not just me making it up. There's been lab tests that have tested out vegan protein powders and have shown that they're like quite a bit above the acceptable limits for heavy metal content. So everything that we've really touched on in this conversation, it is important for someone who wants to be a more savvy consumer and doesn't want to potentially go too far on the opposite side of what they intended doing by using supplements, which is they're trying to improve their health, yet a supplement can very much actually do the opposite of that if you're not using them in a well-reasoned way.
Ben, if you've still got, have you got a chunk of time now? Can I continue this thread?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
To like I'm the good, next, man. Like an extra 50 minutes or so.
Sure.
Yeah, you've given me another reason. I just had a chat with Greg Potter, and he actually was the person who, like, I forget, I wanted to try and say it for the listeners. There's somewhere in Africa where there's more heavy metals within the dark chocolate and other places in Africa where there's less. So he informed me of that. And I was like, I think it's Lindt. It's like a very popular dark chocolate here that a lot of people yeah. consume. And that actually was from the area, like it was from an area in Africa where it would have more of this heavy metal. And if you're consuming that a lot, it's like a problem. So like I moved that, but it's given me more and more reasons to go and get like some blood work done, because I haven't, like I, again, like I'm taking vitamin D, magnesium, zinc, all at like what would be considered like reasonable doses, nothing crazy, but still it's like, I don't know what's going on under the hood. And one I've heard, actually, I'm interested in your thoughts on this, Ben. Ashwagandha, people, I've seen anecdotal reports. Whenever I kind of post about ashwagandha as being potentially something that you want to take for like something you could take for stress reduction as an example, yeah. people always come back and have these like reports of people saying how anecdotally it leads to them like have being like apathetic and all their emotions are gone. Have you heard that?
I have seen that the tide is a little bit turned on ashwagandha. I was never that impressed by it, by the data. I know it was very heavily funded, especially by the company that made the KSM license extract. And that started a long time ago and they pushed really hard. They funded a lot of the studies. Potentially can be conflict of interest, but I was never that impressed. I had used it. I had tried it just out of, you know, I'm always, again, looking as a formulator. I want to do sort of a, let's say a bioassay in myself to see if there's something really there. And I was never really impressed by it in my own use either, on top of just not really being highly convinced on the data. Ironically, the thing that seems to have the best data I've seen for anti-anxiety was kava, but the reason we've never used it is just for that concern that seems to not be as high of a concern before, but still enough of a concern that I would not feel safe including it with the liver stuff. Bacopa is an ingredient I liked for anti-anxiety. I actually liked it better than ashwagandha, especially because it has just benefits beyond just the anti-anxiety. I think the only drawback is it does take a little more longer use to notice those. So I think people who want that instantaneous anti-anxiety effect probably won't feel it. I would say there's probably better ways to go about getting anxiety reduction than from ashwagandha. Like I think even general things like 5-HTP will do that. DL-phenylalanine could produce that. That's just an amino acid. It's just a mix of both isomers, the D and the L. I also think that one of the most fascinating ingredients that I'm surprised didn't blow up, and we did include it in a product that we had called Zen with De Novo, is scalecium is the herb, and Kana was the licensed form of the extract. So I've seen in some pre-workouts they've put in Kana. I would question why it would fit in a pre-workout, but there was very fascinating data, and even mechanistically, it functions as an SRI, and just like a low potency one. And those are all things that were more fascinating to me than ashwagandha was. And you can even look on, you know, user experience profiles, like places like Reddit. That's one of the most highly not sought after, but just based on user experience, people kind of rank that as one of the highest things that they felt an impact from. And I would say in my personal use as well, it is a very peaceful feeling ingredient, and it's very potent. I mean, it's 20 milligrams is all you need for that. So I think if people were really looking for that, I think you can also make a pretty strong case that there's ways to produce that without supplements.
Sure.
For example, just going out, getting some sunlight, yeah, meditating, a lot of stuff like that. But if you're really hell bent on finding a supplement ingredient, I think I would probably chase those before I'd probably go down the route of ashwagandha, because I just never really bought a lot of the data on it. And I did hear some of those anecdotes as well that you've mentioned. And like I said, I think that's probably why there's some of the pushback happening. And you need to realize, again, is, you know, there is always potential. You are, to be frank, you're fucking with your neurotransmitters. So there's always potential to produce an unwanted effect, because even if you have this this research study that, let's say, looks at a pool, and especially in supplements, it looks at a subject pool of 20 individuals. That's not really a big, that there's not a lot of statistical power in 20. And it shows that in 90% of these people, it produced a positive impact, or where it improved their, let's just say, anxiety. It doesn't necessarily mean it applies to everybody in the general population. And we know that even with pharmaceuticals that have a pretty well-established track record, that, you know, you can put someone on an antidepressant and it actually makes them more depressed and have more suicidal ideation. So you just need to go in being aware that you are, yes, acutely and not as potently as a pharmaceutical, but you are fucking with your neurotransmitters.
Yeah, it's, again, I think it's one of those where it's a supplement, and so people view it as like safe. It's like, it's fine. But I guess like a key thing there is just, if you're taking something and something feels different and you haven't changed anything else, it very may well be that thing, even though like some of them aren't that potent, but everyone's that little bit different. And I know for some of these, like ashwagandha, that's something I always would say to people, was like, I think they've only looked at the safety for like 12 weeks or whatever, not longer than that. So I'm always like, you probably need to take a break after 12 weeks, or like it's a safe bet to take a break. Would you say the same for some other of these like more herbs and things that haven't been studied for longer periods of time?
Yeah, I think it's always better to err on the side of caution. I think if you really, the same rationale applies to dose as it does to long-term use of something, is if you don't really feel you need it, you probably shouldn't be using it. And it's the same way I look at dose escalation, is if you notice you have this, and I'm not saying you need to chart this in an Excel spreadsheet or something, but
yeah,
if you notice that you've been over time escalating your dose of something like caffeine or something, I do think you need to look at, are you trying to band-aid an issue? Because that could lead you down a very dangerous path for numerous reasons. But I think you should only ever increase if you actually do need a little more stimulation, not just because you're trying to get, you know, jacked out of your mind, or, you know, stimmed out of your mind, or because you think you need 300 because this product has 300 and that's what they're dosing it at. Like, we even put on our labels, like, start at half dose. what's the drawback for that? If you feel that product and you're getting the intended effect at half the dose, you've just now doubled the effective length you're going to be able to use that product. You've saved money and you're getting what you wanted from it. So I realize that, you know, peer pressure and there's a lot of social things that go into product use and stuff like that. But I think there's no good reason to not start lower and then only go up if you need to. And I think the second thing is, you know, dosage form and route of administration, or the way you're dosing something, is an impact as well. And I think it was a very popular thing that I still see people do. Maybe, I don't know how much it may have died off or not, but stuff like dry scooping, understand that, you know, you're taking all of that dosage in a very short time frame. So how that's going to affect the curve of how it reaches your blood is going to be, as opposed to, let's say you mix a pre and you kind of sip it for 15-20 minutes, you're getting a little more of a kind of flattened exposure in the blood, versus when you dry scoop, you take that high potency dose, you're going to spike a lot faster. So anytime with a higher dose or a higher spike in the blood, yes, you will feel it stronger and faster, but you also increase the potential of side effects from that. So again, these are all just simple things you could do to potentially use supplements a little smarter as well, and improve the safety of the same exact product just in the way you're using it.
I know I've used your products before that you've produced, and you have the directions, like you talk about these sort of things, which most companies don't. And I love that, like, level. And as a consumer, I think the people who are buying your product also like that you talk about those things and how they can get the most from
it. They read it.
Yeah. This might be my final question for you, Ben. I'm just throwing it at you because you mentioned this CYP1A2, kind of the metabolization of caffeine. And I just heard it somewhere recently, was this supplement called, I think it's called Rutacarpine, which I think has been shown to help. I think it's been in some rodent studies. It's metabolized caffeine like quicker. So I think some people are saying you could potentially take this. And if you've, like, I don't know, like you said, you've been upping your dose of caffeine, you're having lots of coffees, but then you chuck this in the mix and it kind of metabolizes it quicker for you, so you can kind of get away with it. I don't know if you've heard of this supplement or you've got any kind of thoughts on it.
I have heard of the ingredient before. I don't know a lot about it, but I think my initial skepticism would be, just like I said, you're fucking with neurotransmitters. I think when you are playing with metabolic pathways, you have to realize that they don't exist in isolation. So you need to understand that if you block a metabolic pathway, it doesn't just, these are families of enzymes that metabolize, they metabolize compounds based upon structural similarity. So what that means is there's a lot of different, when you eat foods, it's funny because people have described, like with chemophobia, have described Pop-Tarts as a chemical shitstorm. But the reality is every day, just by eating, it's a chemical shitstorm. Like there's a ton of like in a banana, there's a ton of chemicals, individual chemicals. And these families of enzymes metabolize multiple different things. So just because it's most relevant to caffeine doesn't mean that it only metabolizes caffeine. Just like I said, birth control will impact how you metabolize caffeine. And a lot of times you have shared metabolism of certain things. And that's why even to use another herb, like St. John's wort, you have to be careful with, because it uses a different enzyme and it will kind of reduce the expression. So if you're on a certain medication, it will change the way you metabolize that medication, and that could potentially be dangerous. So I think if that's true, let's say it ramps up metabolism, or it induces CYP1A2, meaning it causes more production of that enzyme. The drawback of that isn't really that you can take more caffeine, because you have to realize that if you're metabolizing caffeine faster, you're going to be kind of coming down quicker too. You're going to be crashing quicker from it. So I don't buy that that's necessarily a protection from it. I actually think most people probably want caffeine to last longer. So you'd probably want to inhibit CYP1A2 if you want most of the experience from what people like from caffeine. So I don't know that that to me sounds like a lot more of a marketing promise than something that's probably practically going to be beneficial. I'll need to look into it more myself. But also understand that if you impact or influence your metabolism of caffeine by inducing CYP1A2, you're going to change how you metabolize other things too.
I always come back to this phrase, for every gimme, there's a gotcha. Like there's almost, and supplements, it just feels this way where it's like, especially coming away from this conversation with you, Ben, I've got a newfound respect for supplements and also how I should be more careful, especially when it's not protein powders and like carbohydrate powders and things outside of like maybe omega-3s and creatine. Like I need to be thinking a little bit more about kind of even the way I talk about them with clients or even talk about them to people on the internet. Like getting that blood work is actually maybe more important than I had initially thought. So I think that's been really powerful. And also obviously all the practical advice you gave to consumers, I think it's been super helpful. I do want to make sure that people are aware again of Elemental Formulation and obviously the work you're doing there. Have you guys got any kind of new products or any launches that are going on at the moment that the consumers and listeners should be aware of?
We did just recently launch, ironically, a stronger version of our pre-workout called Prime Pre X. It's just for people who want a little more stimulation. We added yohimbine, which is a safe but stronger stimulation than just caffeine alone. We still have all the other products in line. The Prime Pre, while we're out of Utopia, we will be restocking that. So anybody who's heard about it and is wanting to get it, just be patient. It's coming. Other than that, no, I mean, it's a challenging time in the supplement industry with inflation and all the raw materials going up and people obviously budgeting more and probably not having as much to spend on supplements, and just ever increasing competition and marketing. So, as of right now, that's it. I always have stuff floating around in the brain, but nothing in the pipeline right now that's about to come out beyond those things, just restocking.
I know. I think I saw with whey protein prices, people were talking about it. I'm fortunate enough not to have to buy it too often through my sponsor. Yeah. But I know like people were saying on my protein, like their prices are literally like doubled. Like they were looking at them.
I mean, creatine spiked, everything spiking. So it's very, very, very tough to meet, I think, a price point that consumers want and then enough area where you can have a margin to survive as a business too.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. I can, like, as maybe some of the listeners know, I was with you under DeNovo and love the products under there. And I love what you guys are doing with Elemental Formulations as well. And like I think after people have heard this whole thing, if they're still listening, they've got to be pretty sold that it's probably a product that they maybe want to check out. So guys, definitely check it out. If people want to kind of keep up with the brand or what you're doing, Ben, is there anywhere people should head?
I always say that my Instagram is probably the best place. I don't post a ton, but you know, if people wanted to contact me, that's probably the best place. It's just at Ben Esgro. The website for the products is elemental.fit. Elemental Formulations is the Instagram handle. I do have a side project that I bring up every time called SupSci. It's just so hard for me to really invest in that the way I want to, because the reality is it needs to be monetized to be able to allocate that time with all of my other time sinks. So it just keeps getting the back seat. I do think there's worthwhile information still there on that page. It just hasn't been as active, but the intent there was to help people understand supplements better. And I would like to build that out maybe in the future. I think I will always exist no matter what happens in the supplement space in terms of making products. I'd like to always be involved in it. So, I would like at some point long-term to kind of build that out into some type of curriculum. So I think those things are all worth checking out and following. And I hope if nothing else, I know there was a lot of details in a lot of areas we covered. I never want to give people paralysis by analysis. I know there's a lot of information covered, but if nothing else, just focus on every time I said the practical takeaway, I think that's the biggest, most important parts of the conversation for people to take.
I agree. And I liked what you were doing. As I was doing research for the podcast, I looked at that page and some of the posts you'd obviously done. And it was like, it's definitely great information. But creating an infographic, the amount that just goes into creating it, let alone all the research and everything else that goes behind it, it's a lot. So yeah, definitely guys, support Ben. Go check out the product. I'll make sure everything's linked in the description box below. And we'll talk to you next time. Take care.
Losing weight fast while maintaining muscle mass. Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? It isn't though, it's reality and we know how to do it. And we will help you achieve this. The Minicut Movement is an 8-week fat loss program to make you lose a huge chunk of fat while maintaining muscle mass at the same time. We will support you from the beginning to the end so that you see the results you would like to and come out of it much stronger. You'll receive a fully automated spreadsheet that is based on your nutritional needs. You can choose between 6 different male and female training templates. Over 30 videos will guide you through each and every single step of the Minicut so that you're getting the most out of your journey and that you always know what to do. But the best thing is that you can start whenever you want. The Minicut Movement is open 24/7. So if you want to learn more or you're ready to sign up, hit the link in the description below. So let's revive stronger together.